Greetings, everyone, and welcome back to the Mark Fraley Podcast. Today is May 10, 2024. A cool and cloudy day here in Nashville after a week of steady rain and some rather harsh weather in some parts of Tennessee. And of course, the cicadas have invaded Nashville. You may in fact hear them in the audio of this interview. Thanks as always to Ron Trammell for our theme music. What a wonderful and sometimes challenging thing it is that many of our state and local parks and recreation agencies have very important historical sites to manage and care for as part of their mission. Back in the summer of 2017, I recorded an interview for this podcast with Zeta Law on the subject of the historic Fort Negley here in Nashville. This fort has for many years been under the purview of the Nashville Parks and Recreation Department. Zeta is a historical archaeologist affiliated with Middle Tennessee State University. At that time, there was a little bit of a controversy brewing over the conversion for development of a portion of the park which had previously been the Greer Stadium minor league baseball field. Ms. Law advanced the evidence that there were human burials at that site associated with settlements around the fort during the Civil War. It was clear that the proposed development would be detrimental to that place. Thankfully, the developmental project was abandoned in favor of letting the dedicated parkland remain as parkland. And so 6 years later, I continue to be fascinated by Fort Negley, and I regularly follow events and activities there on social media. Yesterday, I was privileged to be able to chat with Dr. Angela Sutton, a historian affiliated with Vanderbilt University. Over the past several years, Dr. Sutton, the Friends of Fort Negley organization, and others have been developing information about the people who built the fort and who occupied the surrounding area during the Civil War. And importantly, about the descendants of those initial settlers, connecting those people to the predominantly black Bass Street neighborhood that existed there up until the demise of that neighborhood brought about by the development of Interstate 40. What they are uncovering is advancing our understanding of that historical place and serving to rebuild lost connections to that place. I sure hope you will enjoy this interview with Dr. Angela Sutton. And we will get started right after this brief message.
Hi, this is Heather Lose, Editor-in-Chief of the Tennessee Conservationist Magazine. Every year, we publish six beautiful issues packed full of timely and informative stories about Tennessee culture, people, and places. You can stay informed about your world and all the great things happening in your Tennessee state parks. It's easy to subscribe. Just go to our website at tnconservationist.org. Thank you.
Angela Sutton, welcome to the Mark Fraley Podcast.
Hi, thank you.
Well, it's great to have you and great to finally meet you, if not in person, over the interweb, as they say.
Yeah, you too.
Well, Angela, today I want to talk with you about what's going on at Fort Negley, which is, as you know, a historic Civil War era fort here in Nashville. And we're going to talk about that in some great detail and about what you're doing there, which is fascinating to me. As we get started, it's kind of a tradition on this program to talk with my guests about their influences and what got them into the profession that they're in. You are a professor at Vanderbilt University in the history department, and I guess you're involved in the administration of scholarly affairs over there as a dean or an assistant dean. Mm-hmm. But your focus is on cultural resources and history. Tell us a little bit about your background, how you got to Nashville, and what got you interested in that field.
Sure. Yeah, it's kind of a circuitous route, but so I'm German and American. My father is a U.S. soldier. He was a veteran, and my mother is German, and he met her when he was overseas. And I lived in Germany until I was 17, and then I moved to Scotland to do my undergraduate degree there because they have an agreement with the EU that any EU citizen does not pay tuition at all. And so I had this really beautiful opportunity to get an undergraduate education without taking out any debt, and I took it. And then when I graduated from Scotland, I worked for a year at a maritime museum there, which was one of the best jobs of my life. And then I came here to Nashville to do my PhD at Vanderbilt when I was 23. And I thought I would just be here for 5 years, in and out really quickly. But I fell in love with Bentley, and I found I couldn't leave.
Very good. Your sound is breaking up a little bit on me. I don't know what's happening. Let's
when you hear me breaking up, what I hear from you is like a really strong wave of like static. Really strange.
Well, it is odd. We'll have to put that up to maybe the cicada invasion. I don't know. Maybe that's the thing that's causing the interference. Well, fascinating. So Fort Negley itself was part of the reason why you've stayed here.
Yeah, yeah. It's one of those things where like you start something and then you have to see it through to the end, right? There's no way I can leave now. It's in the middle of its story.
Well, let's talk about Fort Negley. Your sound is much better now, by the way. Let's talk about Fort Negley and what it is for our general audience. I mean, there are going to be people that are going to know about it, and for other people, it will be a brand new subject. So tell us about Fort Negley and why it's an important place.
Fort Negley is the most incredible place I've ever had the privilege of being at, and I'm very well traveled. So Fort Negley was built by enslaved and black people. Many of them who had run all over the South, and some of them from the North as well, to hide behind our federal military lines for safety from slave captures. And they built this fort together, and then they built an entire system of fortifications in a semicircle right around the Capitol in order to keep it safe from the Confederate attack. After they built this fort, many of them were either forced or asked to join the military. I just keep wanting to emphasize that there's a lot of diversity, right? Like there was not a monolith. Many people had many different ideas of how and why they were there and what they wanted to accomplish there. But many of them joined the military and fought as part of our segregated regiments in the U.S. military in the Battle of Nashville. So there were 13,000 Black soldiers in the Battle of Nashville, which is by far the largest Black participation in any Civil War battle. And then you take these 13,000 and you add them to the 4,933 people who were building these fortifications and the wartime infrastructure. You've got over 19,000 people who had nowhere to return to after the war, right? They were not going to return to their places of enslavement. And so they remained right here. Many of them settled at the foot of the fort. Many of them went to our other Black neighborhoods in the city. And they really started Nashville's Black population. And many, many people who are Black and from Nashville who've been here for several generations are from this population.
Well, that's very, very well stated. Let's drop back a second and give a geographic bird's eye view of where Fort Negley sits in relation to downtown Nashville. And so we have I-40 that runs east and west through the city of Nashville. So if you're coming into Nashville from the east, Fort Negley will be on your left side, up on a prominent hill. As you see the skyline of Nashville on the right, Fort Negley will be there on your left. You'll see the Cumberland Science Museum, which sits on Bass Street. Remember that name, Bass Street. And then up on that top of that hill is Fort Negley.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, it's like right by the I-40, I-65 interchange. And at one of the memorial events that I attended last year, I mentioned, you know, just a few miles from downtown. And former Mayor Cooper corrected me. He's like, Angela, it's downtown now.
Well, that's right. Downtown has come out to it, hasn't it? You know, and Nashville was among the early cities in the South to actually fall to the Union occupation relatively early in the war. So, in fact, there's actually a book called Nashville, the Occupied City, which my old friend wrote, whose name is escaping me, Walter Durham, wrote that book about Nashville's occupation during the war. So this fort was built at, you know, after Nashville was taken over by the Union Army as a fortification.
Challenge the way that you're phrasing that.
Okay, please.
So I don't like to think of it as like a takeover because half of us wanted them there.
Well, of course. Right.
Half of the white population wanted them there and most of the black population wanted them there. So more than half of us wanted the Union and cooperated with the federal forces in order to stop the Confederacy. Right. So like Nashville is such an interesting place because we were not firmly in any camp. Like there was so much division and most people who I speak with, they have family who fought on both sides of this war. So it really is very complex here in Tennessee.
Right. And but the fort was built as a way to sort of consolidate the fact that the Union was in control of this geographic region.
Mm-hmm, for sure. And, right. And also to, you know, because Nashville is so strategic still today, right? The reason we have three highways is because we're right in the middle of everything important, right? Right? We are that transit area. Everything has to pass through Nashville. And it was the same during the Civil War, right? Like, strategically, Nashville was the second most fortified city, only second to Washington, D.C. And it's because everyone sort of knew that Nashville is that important place right in the center between North and South that would determine the end of the war, right? And so when Nashville was fortified, what you really have is this like semicircle of forts that kind of surround downtown. And this semicircle of fortifications forced the Confederates to attack in a pincer form, which was really incredibly ill-advised. And I don't think would have happened had Hood been in his right mind at all.
And the even today, Fort Negley is surrounded by railroad tracks. So then those railroad lines were in existence at the time of the Civil War, east and west, north and south, and they go right by Fort Negley. And, you know, Fort Negley at the time was a place where a very prominent view of the downtown capital could be very easily seen from that hilltop. So that, you know, Fort...
Sorry, go ahead. I'm the worst. So the railroad is incredibly strategic, and there's a story related to that most people don't know here in Nashville, which is that after the war, when all the war dead were collected in order to be sent back to their families, many of them were brought to Fort Negley because of its proximity to the railroad and because they had so many USCT working and stationed there during Reconstruction. And so what happened was that there was a huge collection of black, white, Confederate, and federal forces that were all there. All of their corpses were collected there, and they were buried in a big pit, all the ones who went unclaimed. The ones who were claimed were put onto the train and sent back home via the train to their families. So the unclaimed people were buried in a big mass grave there, and then they were moved to the federal cemetery, or national cemetery up in on Gallatin Road, right? And so, but not everybody was moved. We have the list of everybody that was interred, and then we have the list of everyone that was buried in Madison, and those lists don't match up, which is why people keep talking about all the bodies that are at Fort Negley.
Oh, I see. Well, and these lists of persons that were involved in Fort Negley are prominent in the work that you do. Mm-hmm. Tell us about where these lists of people have come from, I guess the sources, and how you're using those lists today.
Yeah, thank you. So this has been some of the most important work and also the biggest honor of my life to do. Essentially, I was working with Tania Kuntz from the Afro-American Historical and Genealogical Society back when I was collecting descendant stories. And she said that she knows a lot of people who believe that they are descended from a Black soldier in the Civil War, but have no way of confirming that because it's a really difficult process to dig up a lot of this information. And I said, well, what is that process? Because as a white person, I didn't know what went into Black genealogy and how it was different. Though I should have, right? Because sources are very different. A lot of the sources related to Black people were not treated with the same reverence and respect as the sources related to white people. And so I spoke to her and I said, like, how could we help? And so we brainstormed and we kind of went through, like, what are all the sources that talk about the soldiers at Fort Negley? What are all the sources to do with the laborers? And what are all the sources to do with the people who, the veterans, essentially, after the war? Like, where did they go? How were they captured in the historical record? And so we went about collecting those. And as I was collecting, I found that so many Nashvillians had already had that idea, right? It was not an original idea by any means. And so I got to meet with people like Fletch Koch, people like Carter Newton, who is up at the Tennessee Central Railroad, Linda Wynn, like people who had already done some of the research, who had some research prepared for me already. And then descendants who had all this stuff in their attics, like descendants who had collected their own family history and all those programs with people's names on them, right? And I was just like amazed that there's so much stuff. And then of course the Tennessee State Central Archives, Chuck Sherrill, who's the former state archivist and librarian, he was a really big help and he showed me some of his research that he had done on the penitentiary 20 years ago that had so many USC soldiers in it because many soldiers who were seen as being subordinate ended up in the penitentiary. And when they're captured in the penitentiary records, all this other personal information about them that's there that you can't find anywhere else. And so essentially
is also captured, right? Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
And so then what I ended up doing was writing a couple of grants. I was funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities and the National Park Service. I got enough money to hire myself an assistant and a system architect. And we created the database together using everyone in Nashville's research, all of their transcriptions, all of their everything, right? Everything that they've done. Plus looking at some new material that no one had got to yet. And we put it all into a database, made it searchable, made it relational, which means when you find one person, you can find all the people that they knew and that they were related to. So all the people that either worked with them on the fortifications, all the people that served with them in the same regiment, all the people who were incarcerated alongside them at the same time, because often those relationships are what is lost in the documentary records. We wanted to give those back to people. So just last year, I finished the Builders and Defenders database, which you can find at www.buildersanddefenders.org. So now there's over 19,000 Black people and their personal information in this database, and about 3,000 of the white people that they either served alongside, were enslaved by, or otherwise had important interactions with.
Very good. If you're a park manager, and you have a really remarkable physical place like Fort Negley, it tends just to be a place. But when you have connections with the community that you can document and develop, that just makes it so much, such a more lively living place. I guess that's the result of what you're doing. But what are you learning from all these connections that you're making?
Oh my God, I'm learning that I know so little, and that so much of my training as a professional historian has not equipped me to do this work. I learned that Black people know so much about themselves, and that as a white person, I was raised to not understand when they told me, or to not hear when they told me, and it took me a really long time to reorient the way I listen and the way that I understand. And that's been quite a process.
Well, that's fascinating. And I'd like to hear you talk a little more about that.
Yeah, sure. So for example, the other day I was interviewing a man called Vernus Scruggs. He is 90 years old. He was born in the Bass Street Baptist Church at the foot of the hill in Fort Negley 90 years ago. And now he is still at the Bass Street Church, even though it has moved twice. He remained with that church. So for 90 years, he's been part of this community. Of Civil War veterans and their descendants, right? So I spoke with him, and I asked him about all the important institutions that his life touched on, because those institutions often create records, and I can go back and find those records when he tells me a name or a date or an important event, right? I can sort of start helping him dig up some of those things. And so I would ask him something like, do you remember who your seventh grade teacher was at Cameron? And he would instead of telling me a name of a teacher, which is how I would answer that question, he memory palaced it. He would spend time putting together all of the other things that he had remembered alongside that seventh grade teacher's name. And so he told me the whole story of his education. And the reason why he did that is how he remembered. And that is how he trained himself to both put that into his memory and then spit it out when he told it to his children and his grandchildren. And these are ways that a lot of older Black Americans have remembered, because they couldn't trust that they had the same types of sources and resources that we did in order to record all of that and keep it accessible for the community. And so what we have written on paper, speaking of white people, what we have written in newspaper, what is on our TV, what's on PBS, all the places that cater to us, he couldn't rely on those, and so he had to put them all into his memory. And so he has got this remarkable memory and this remarkable way of speaking about the past that really kind of put me to shame, because I am one third of his age and I can't remember as much as he can about his past.
That's fantastic. So, you know, as you go into the visitor center, there at Fort Negley, on the walls in the conference room are the pictures of a couple dozen black soldiers who are identified. Have we been able to get into the stories of those individuals?
Yeah. Many stories now. But we're still in the infancy of putting these stories together. But the Afro-American Historical, we're really lucky. So the Afro-American Historical and Genealogical Society is working with descendants of the soldiers to piece those stories together and collect them. But also the person who was one of the media relations people of that group is now the assistant director of the visitor center. So now we have a Black genealogist who's the assistant director of the center. And that makes all the difference in terms of what people will tell her, what types of people will come in and share information, and how those stories can sort of be built up together as a community.
Very good. All right. So we in discussing the geolocation of Fort Negley, we talked about Bass Street, and you mentioned the Bass Street Church, what happened, and you may talk about this in more detail, is after the Civil War, settlements and neighborhoods grew up in Nashville, and one was there on Bass Street, right at the foot of St. Cloud Hill, which was prominently an African American neighborhood, and that neighborhood has since been obliterated by the construction of I-40 as we know it, going through town. But the records remain. So tell us about what you're learning about Bass Street, the connection between the people that lived there up until, you know, the early 70s or late 60s, and their connection to the fort.
Yeah. And so this is sort of, this is the whole story of Nashville and Bass Street in a small little nutshell, right? Because after the war, a lot of these forts, they kept the presence of USCP soldiers during Reconstruction to help technically to help reconstruct, though we were abandoned. that project was abandoned. But so during this Reconstruction process, many Black communities settled around these forts, because the forts were places that were signs of freedom, right? It was places where they had labored specifically to help the war effort and to create a place where we could all live without legal enslavement. Like that was the goal of the people who had built and who had fought in the war. And so that's why when you think about like the Edge Hill community, that's a Black neighborhood, because it had two forts in it. It had Fort Casino and Fort Morton, which are the Reservoir, as well as E.S. Rose Park, that are both in Edge Hill. And then up in North Nashville, you've got Fisk University's Jubilee Hall that sits on top of Fort Gillem, which used to be a fortification as well. And that's why you have that Black neighborhood there right next to Fisk University. Right, this the Civil War shaped our entire human geography here.
I had no idea that Fisk was involved with that in that way. So,
yeah. And then, so like at Bass Street, what happened was, of course, Fort Negley is the biggest fort, so you get the biggest neighborhood. And so when you think about, like, if you go to the fort, you see like where the Adventure Science Center is, and you see the highway that's in front of it. All of that was the Bass Street neighborhood. So directly underneath the Adventure Science Center, the artifact of our neighbors here at Fort Negley, the Bass Street community. And these neighborhoods were ceded by Black Civil War veterans and their families and their descendants who lived together for about 80 to 90 years, becoming one another's families, and like uninterrupted for most of that part. And what we're learning about this neighborhood is truly spectacular, because we've been so fortunate to have archaeologists from MTSU go in there and do some test pits and try to find out what it is that we can know. And these archaeologists were wonderful, because they were told, oh, that place has been bulldozed. There's nothing there. You can just use that as like a training ground for your first year students. But then they did find something. And when they found something, they reached out to me and they're like, Angela, I think we need to talk to the descendants. Like we found their things. And so, of course, I reached out immediately to the people I knew who were from that community. And Miss Janine Blackman of the African American Cultural Alliance, she took over from the late Kwame Lillard, who was in charge of that since the 70s, I think. He is a descendant of that space. Her grandmother lived right where the left lane is on I-65, right? That's where her grandmother's house is.
Gracious.
Yes. And so she found a bunch of people from Bass Street through the church, because we're fortunate that after urban renewal, the church was forced to move. But a lot of the parishioners went with the church.
Of course.
To Brick Church Pike, and they lost a lot of people because it's quite a long drive and not everybody could afford a car back then. But they kept about half their parishioners. And so most of these parishioners that are with the Bass Street Church are direct descendants of Civil War veterans who fought in the Battle of Nashville and then settled at the foot of Fort Negley. So we were able to speak to many people who remembered living in Bass Street as children. So I mentioned Mr. Vernus Scruggs. There was also Mr. Philip Minter, his aunt Mildred Hendricks, several other people that we've had the fortune to speak with who can tell us what it was like there. And the other day, I took Miss Janine to the anthropology lab at MTSU, and we laid out the artifacts from Bass Street. And the archaeologists there, Andrew Wyatt and Clayley Cottle Peacock, they sat down and they told Miss Janine about what they knew from their research about these objects. They were like, this is who made them. This is, you know, what they were generally used for. This is how long they were in circulation. And then Miss Janine would pick them up and go, ah, that's true, but my grandmother had one and this is how she used it. And so there's this really beautiful meaning making that was happening between descendants and archaeologists looking at essentially what the remains of Miss Janine's family's life.
Fascinating. It occurs to me as a amateur genealogist myself that there are census records for those neighborhoods from 1860, 1870. I guess it wouldn't not necessarily be 1860, but each 10 year period. Are we correlating what we're finding on the census with the other records that you have? And tell us about that.
Yes. So yeah, that was one of the more beautiful moments. In 2022, we had a community archaeology day where several descendants were invited onto the site while the students were digging, because there was some really important conversations occurring between the two about what was being found. And when that happened, we essentially learned that we took the list of all the people who had lived there in that first census, was it 1905 census? Perhaps.
Well, they're in 10-year periods, 1900, 1910, 1920.
So yeah. The 1910 one, because yeah. The 1910 was not available for some reason.
Right.
We looked at that 1910 census, and we were able to take that and compare it with those fire insurance maps that came out where they would like list out where people lived. So we could take the addresses and correlate to where we were digging, which was very cool. And so we were able to find like, oh, this is the house. Like one of the houses I remember was the home of a woman named Annie who had a husband who worked at Tennessee Central Railroad. And that comes into play because the folks at Tennessee Central Railroad were so good as to like help us look for his employment record, which we found, which is very exciting. And then she also mentioned she had a son named Luther who was old enough to work, but instead of working, she sent him to school. And so his occupation was student. That says a lot too about this neighborhood. They were deeply aspirational. All of the things the archaeologists have found sort of like cooperated with that. The deeply aspirational neighborhood He knew where they were going and he wanted to get there fast.
I'm learning as we go here to try to mute my microphone when you're talking. So if it clicks in and out for you and my listeners, I think maybe the sound of the cicadas in the background is what's interfering with, because it seems to be clarifying what I'm hearing from you if I mute my microphone. Fascinating to hear. You know, in doing a little bit of genealogy for a black friend of mine, and looking at those records in these neighborhoods, we saw a lot of masons and bricklayers and stone workers. And what I've often thought was that they may have learned that trade while building Fort Negley or building the reservoir on the above Edge Hill there.
I think they must have learned it before then, because if you look at Belmead and all the other places where the plantations were.
There you go.
Right. They were all built by enslaved hands, every single one of them. And so, of course, that's where the Union soldiers went to when they needed more laborers. They raided those plantations with the beautiful walls because they knew that the enslaved people living there were stonecutters who knew what they were doing. So, for example, everyone knows William Atkinson, right? And if you don't, you got to research him, because he is one of America's, one of Nashville's most famous sons. But William Edmondson, the artist, his father and grandfather and uncle all cut stone at Fort Negley, right? That's how he learned how to cut stone, from people who had been enslaved and who had been doing this for generations. He comes from a whole line of stonecutters.
And in his work, for those that are not familiar, is collected worldwide, and just beautiful, beautiful stuff. And I guess there's a park named after him over there in the Edge Hill community now.
Yes, the William Edmondson home site, which is such an exciting place. I was just there. I'm going there right after this because they're doing ground penetrating radar, which they're calling non-destructive archaeology, to find out what's underneath that basketball court in that park, because we are trying to find the outlines of William Edmondson's home site, as well as his workshop. And possibly even there could be some pieces of rock that he abandoned that sort of halfway through, right? So mm-hmm. We're hoping there may be a possibility under that park somewhere. There's another original Edmondson just waiting to be discovered.
That's fantastic. So let's, for our listeners who are curious about this and want to learn more and be more involved, tell us what opportunities there are for just, general citizens that are interested to involve themselves in what you're doing or to learn more about Fort Negley.
Sure. Yeah, I think the best thing to do would be to join the Friends of Fort Negley. They've got a mailing list where they put out all of the events. We have wonderful lectures. We have all kinds of things, brown bag lunches. And this weekend, I think we have the University School of Nashville students coming into immersive theater, all about the Civil War and Reconstruction era in Nashville. So there are a number of things. There's also a really cool fossil finders program. It has nothing to do with the Civil War history, but it's still very exciting and a great place for children to get really interested in physical aspects of the work.
Yeah, Fort Negley being on that hillside, there's a couple places where there's been excavation into the side hill, and it's exposed some layers of rocks that are interesting geologically. I guess Dr. Molly Miller is the individual from Vanderbilt Geology Department that leads those programs at Fort Negley.
Yes, and Sharon Francis as well, her other colleague. They're both retired now, so they get to spend more time with Fort Negley, which makes me very jealous.
Yeah, Dr. Miller used to be a neighbor here on White Oak Drive. So she's just a delightful person, and shares the distinguishing feature of having a joint professorship with her husband for many years. I don't know whether whether that was always the case, but for a period of time, they shared a position in the geology department there, but wonderful people. So, Angela, you have just recently published a book And I wanted you to have an opportunity to talk to us about that and promote it a little bit if you would like.
Thank you. Yeah, it's called Pirates of the Slave Trade, The Battle of Cape Lopez and the Birth of an American Institution. A lot of people think, like, what do pirates have to do with Fort Negley? Absolutely nothing, but also everything. So the book is about the pirates who went and attacked the slave trade in West Africa in the 1700s, and in doing so, completely reshaped the way that the trade and traffic of enslaved human beings happened in Africa, which then in turn changed the way that we had slavery evolve in the United States. And so what we have now in the United States, what we experience is called chattel slavery. That system was not a foregone conclusion. There were many other systems of slavery that existed prior to this point. My book sort of explains why chattel slavery became the predominant form of slavery here and what that means for our history, right? Because in chattel slavery, unlike other forms of slavery, with chattel slavery, you legally become, the enslaved person legally becomes an object instead of a person. And when you grow up in a nation where an entire group of people that are visibly different by skin color are relegated to objecthood instead of personhood, that completely changes the culture of us, the rest of us, right? The rest of us who go along with this process of objectifying human beings. And that, once you understand that, everything else in US history kind of clicks into sharp focus. And I think in doing this study and looking at the ways in which slavery developed in this country through the lens of piracy in Africa, it really helped me to understand the history of Fort Negley in a new way, right? Like Fort Negley is, yes, it's part of an old North versus South narrative, but I think that's really played out. I think the more exciting part of Fort Negley is to really look at it as a cradle of freedom. It's the birthplace of freedom. It's where people who were considered objects in the eyes of the law became Americans. And that to me is such an exciting thing. And it's a thing that the whole city can be proud of and celebrate together.
Well, that's fantastic. And I'm glad that you made that connection between that work and what you're doing there at Fort Negley. You know, many of my listeners are park and recreation professionals, not all of them, but several. What are the lessons that park and recreation professionals need to take away from your observations there at Fort Negley? You've had an opportunity to witness how a city government agency, the Parks and Recreation Division of the City of Nashville, how it has dealt with this resource. I would grade them pretty highly in terms of their recent interaction with the resource, although probably for 100 years I would have given them an F or below for leaving it abandoned. I suppose it took a Yankee raised mayor to come in and revitalize the interest, my old friend Bill Purcell. But
he would tell you he is a Southerner through and through, and he is determined to die in the South.
Well, you know, that I'm to his credit, I've never heard him say that myself, but it's but you know, that fort was truly abandoned for a century. I guess there was a period during the Roosevelt era where they spent some money trying to reclaim it. But what are the lessons that parks and recreation managers what lessons should they take away from that site and sites, similar sites around?
I think that it's so important to not allow these sites to become politicized, right? Like, obviously, everything in America is political now, I understand. Like, I do. I think that for so long in Nashville, this site was really treated as some kind of relic of, like, Northern aggression, which I don't think is fair, and nor is it true, right? That doesn't ring true to the native Nashvillians who've been here their whole lives either. And I'm not sure exactly where that came from. I think, of course, the Lost Cause mythology has a lot to do with it. But it's been so frustrating to see that everyone I speak with loves the fort, and once they find out about it, right? Once they know that it's there, they're like, oh my goodness, I can't believe it's been abandoned, right? And everyone resonates with this history because the history of freedom is the history of America. Like, who doesn't resonate with that? It's so exciting. And so I think that we really can't allow sites like this to fall into disrepair because we're afraid of the interpretation. I think that we have to allow communities to make meaning out of places like this. And I know that for a long time we were afraid to, we were afraid of what kind of meaning would come. But in doing all this work with the descendants and recording their voices with the Fort Negley Descendants Project, in recovering all of their archival data with the Builders and Defenders database, I really come to understand the way Black Nashvillians have seen this fort and their contributions to it. I also did a lot of work to get this fort the UNESCO nomination and then the designation to be on the UNESCO site of memory of the Routes of Enslaved Persons. And in doing that, it sort of helped me to realize that, like, if we remove the site as a sore sticking point of this, like, old North versus South, which is, it's dead anyway, right? It's dead because so many of us have moved away. So many of us have moved to this space. Now, who is a Southerner? Who is a Northerner? That's up for debate again now. So really what it comes down to is taking the time to speak with the people who have been attached to that space and really seeing through their eyes. And I think that park staff do understand that. Like, I know that we've had sort of a thorny relationship because Parks is funded by the city, and it was, you know, the mayor of the city at the time that tried to sell pieces of Fort Negley. And so Parks, their hands were tied. They had to do what the mayor told them to do. But, you know, mayors, they work for us. You know, they don't get to shove things down our throat that we don't agree with. They work for us. We voted them in and we tell them what to do. And so the city told Mayor Megan Barry what to do, right? And Fort was saved because enough of us cared enough about it to not allow it to go to waste like that. So I don't know. Like, I think now, I think Parks has always done a great job, right? Like, I love working with all of my friends over at Parks because they value the research that I do and the community aspect that I bring to the space. So it's been a really fun journey. But it's also been difficult to sort of navigate the politics sometimes, because I just don't think that politics should determine whether or not a space have the prominence it deserves in our city's history.
So I guess Parks has just completed a master planning project, maybe a year or so ago, that they completed that for that site. Were you involved in doing in the master plan development?
Yeah, Parks hired HDLA, Hodgson Douglas Landscape Architects, to go in and sort of envision a new site. And there was a lot of community engagement that was involved with that. They asked what the community wanted. The community was overwhelmingly in favor of, like, no, there should not be baseball pitches. Like, no, there should not be a soccer field. This is a historic park, and we want it to be a space where you can have that moment to reflect and to understand yourself in this space. And so, yeah, I was able to consult with them. They also consulted with many of the descendants that I introduced them to, which was lovely. And I think is so important, right? I don't think we have the right to do anything that the descendants don't want in this space. Like, it is their space. They built it, they defended it, and they died for it. And so to move forward without them just wouldn't be right.
Well, Dr. Sutton, thank you so much for the time you've spent with us today talking about what's going on at Fort Negley. I really do admire your energy and what you're doing there, and I strongly encourage my listeners to get out there and take a look at that site. And when you have visitors coming into Nashville and they want to do something interesting, take them over there. It's in Nashville. There's a lot of things to see that are not on the ordinary tourist lists, and this is one that is definitely worthy. So thank you so much for the time you've spent with us today.
Oh no, thank you. It was so much fun. It's really great chatting with you, Mark.